And a good Friday morning to you. Welcome into the Nick Craig Show, streaming live this morning on YouTube, Rumble, and X. A show available 24/7 via podcast by searching for the Nick Craig Show in your favorite podcast app. And when you head over there, make sure if your store, whatever platform you're listening on, if they give you the option to leave a review, it would be greatly appreciated. Welcome into a Friday edition, a busy show ahead today. And of course, we start this morning where most of the nation continues to seek questions or seek answers. The horrific crash of an American Airlines flight that took place late Wednesday night around 9 o'clock or so, as it was just a couple hundred feet away from landing at Reagan National Airport, DCA, just outside of Washington. And we are getting some additional details this morning about the setup, not necessarily the crash itself. The details on that are, for as of right now, essentially non-existent. What we do know in the last couple of hours is that the black box recorder that was on the American Airlines flight has been recovered by the National Transportation and Safety Board, and they have got that in their lab in Washington, D.C., and hopefully that will shed at least a little bit of light as to what was going on within the cockpit, what was going on with the speed of the plane, all of the pertinent details that we don't have, getting some of that out of the black box, which I learned yesterday in watching the NTSB's press conference, is actually not a black box at all. It is actually an orange box. Not sure why it's called the black box recorder, but that has been recovered. So maybe we'll get some additional details on that. However, there is an interesting story over at the Washington Post this morning. Now, Washington Post is reporting and covering this headline. Quote, helicopters flying along Potomac frequently pose danger to passenger jets. Now, you've heard a lot over the last last day or so about how hectic of an airspace there is in and around Washington, D.C., and specifically Reagan International Airport, which is just a couple of miles from the White House, a couple miles from the Capitol, and from all reports, is pretty much was spawned into existence so that members of Congress could quickly get in and out of the district and in back to, you know, wherever they're from, whatever states that they represent. So this Washington Post article highlights a couple of recent, within the last couple of days, stories and issues that have taken place at Reagan with helicopters. I wanted to go through just a little bit of it this morning. It says, on Tuesday night, just 24 hours before a deadly collision between a military helicopter and a regional jet at Reagan National Airport, a different passenger jet coming in for a landing at the airport alerted the tower that it had to abort, meaning pull out of its landing. The reason? The risk of a possible collision with a helicopter. This was Tuesday night, a night before the crash that has taken the lives now of 60 passengers and four crew members on that flight, plus three additional lives of U.S. service members in the helicopter. A similar situation played out less than a week earlier on January the 23rd when a flight from Charlotte suddenly pulled out of its approach at National. The captain informed passengers that he was tracking a helicopter and needed to abort the landing. Richard Hart, who was a passenger returning from a business flight on that flight from Charlotte, said, quote, they had to circle back around because there was a helicopter in the flight path. At the time, I found it odd. Now I find it disturbingly tragic. The two scrubbed landings within a week illustrates the heightened danger posed by frequent military helicopter flights adjacent to the busy airport, which have been the source of close calls and worries for crashes for years. The Washington Post story then goes through the details as we know it right now on this flight from Wichita, Kansas, that we went into great details yesterday. So this in itself is, of course, incredibly concerning. When you had just one day beforehand a plane having to abort its landing due to the fact that there was a military helicopter that was in its flight path. And, you know, the systems that you've probably heard a little bit about over the last day or so has been the ATC system, which is the ACS system, excuse me, which is the automatic crash system that shows if there is likely to be a crash. It shows if there's likely to be a collision that's going to take place. It, you know, it of course knows in proximity where the plane that it is flying is on. It knows in proximity where other things are that are going on. And you can actually see in a video that was published yesterday morning, that was posted yesterday morning from this is air traffic control radar footage from the tower in at Reagan National Airport. And as you'll see in this video, obviously you can see the two different planes here, or the plane here, the GIA, that's the plane from Wichita, and then this helicopter. And you'll see this red CA light flashing on both. That's indicating collision alert, meaning that these two aircrafts, based on the way in which they're traveling, the speed that they are in, there is the possibility of a collision. And unfortunately, as this goes on, the collision alert light continues to flash, only for then, of course, these two aircrafts to cross paths. And then you can see here at the end of the footage, the planes stop, the one plane and the helicopter stop reporting their relative location as they are, as there's that midair explosion as the fuselage of the American Airlines flight is ripped into three, landing into the Potomac, and the helicopter, just a heaping pile of rubble. So, and the fact that this happened a day before at the same airport, and the pilot fortunately aborted the flight, said, hey, it's too risky, looped around and landed again. And apparently it happened the week before, goes to show you there's issues. Now, I'm not pretending to be a air traffic control expert this morning, anything but that. However, what I do have a lot of expertise in is technology. I've spent my entire life interested and involved in technology, whether that be on the professional standpoint, working in it as business with small businesses and things of that nature. And the technology is there. There is no reasonable explanation that with the technology that is aboard the airplane, the technology that is aboard the helicopter, that something like this should happen. It shouldn't. Now, even the best technological systems to avoid issues don't always work. And it's often in the oftentimes when you've got tragedies like this that take place, something that seems unexplainable. How the hell can a helicopter fly into a plane 400 feet above a runway? How could the helicopter not see the plane? How could the plane not see the helicopter? How could air traffic control not get ahead of this situation beforehand? There's so many questions. And what we end up finding out a majority of the time is that it is a compounding of issues that caused this to take place. And again, the details are still very scarce as of this morning. The NTSB's press conference yesterday, if I'm being honest, was useless. I mean, they provided zero additional information on anything except for the fact of, oh, hey, and we haven't recovered the black box recorder, which, you know, at the time seemed pretty concerning that they hadn't gathered that, but they have since done that. No information there. The only information we learned yesterday throughout the day, we really learned nothing additional outside the day except for this one bit of information. And this harps into this calamity of issues. There's a report that there was only one air traffic controller worker, ATC worker, on two different tower positions at the same time when the tragedy occurred. The controller who was assigned to helicopters in the vicinity of Reagan National Airport was also, quote, instructing planes that were landing and departing from its runway, according to the New York Times. One ATC source told CNN yesterday that one controller working two tower positions simultaneously was not uncommon. However, internal preliminary Federal Aviation Administration reporting obtained by the New York Times stated that staffing at the DCA tower was, quote, not normal for the time of day and the volume of traffic. So I go back to my previous point. When you often have these kind of, as it seems right now, unexplainable tragedies, how does a helicopter fly into a plane at 400 feet from an airport? It's often a compound of issues. And this very well could be one of them. Short staffing at the airport. Okay, that's situation one. There's reports that this that the helicopter, the Army Black Hawk helicopter, could have been possibly using some sort of night vision goggles, which from everything that I watched and read yesterday indicates when you've got these night vision goggles on, this was a training mission going on. With night vision goggles, things can be very disorienting. Even though the pilots, we believe, had somewhere between 500 and 1,000 hours worth of flight time, it can be relatively disorienting. There's other experts and officials that have, not necessarily officials, but experts, people that are familiar with either flying commercial or military in and around Reagan, that have said at night, it is very, very, from the potentially the helicopter standpoint, all of the surrounding lights can be very disorienting at night. You've got bridge traffic. You've got all of the lights from Washington, D.C. You've got the airport. There's a lot of lights in that area, and it can be very disorienting. So we're looking at, when I think this is said and done, there will likely be a series of probably 3 to 5, maybe more things that all kind of push together to bring you what is the worst air tragedy that's affected the United States in modern history. The first airline crash that this country's had in 16 years. And one of the more deadly that the country's ever seen. It's often a calamity of issues that explains the unexplainable. In this case, I don't think we're going to find out that there was one and one only issue that caused this crash. And if that one issue had been averted, then you wouldn't have 67 people that are dead this morning. That's likely what I think this is going to result in. So we've got a couple of issues right off the bat that we're looking at. Issues with military helicopters being in flight paths the night before this happened. Down one person at the air traffic control tower at the DCA tower, and then potentially some other issues with the helicopter, night vision goggles, them calling out and seeing a plane that was not the plane that they were supposed to be looking for, potentially that they were too high, more than 100 feet higher than they should have been under regulation. So many different things. We're awaiting additional details on that, and we'll track them here on the Nick Craig Show and provide them as they come to fruition. So that's kind of the new information that we have this morning, of which I'll admit it's not a whole lot, but we're working towards it. And now I want to talk about yesterday and Trump's reaction to this, because I saw a lot of comments online, a lot of individuals very annoyed and concerned with Trump's comments on the plane crash yesterday, which, by the way, his initial comments on the plane crash, as we covered yesterday morning, were that his heart and prayers are with the families and the military members' families that lost their lives. Those were his initial comments. He made that in a statement the night of the crash. The White House put out a statement around 11 p.m. He then posted something on Truth Social well after midnight, indicating he was still tracking and watching the situation unfold. And so Trump yesterday has a press briefing in the White House press briefing room around 11 o'clock and goes through the, again, very scarce details that we know right now, and then turns to what he talks about in diversity, equity, and inclusion, and talks about staffing issues and talks about some of the issues that the FAA has in regards to how they're staffing these air traffic control towers. And of course, the immediate reaction from individuals, of course, is to claim that Trump is politicizing the tragedy. He's politicizing the deaths of these 67 individuals. And I find that, from the left, to be the most disingenuous argument that you can possibly imagine. Within hours of this disaster unfolding in Washington, D.C., you had news outlets, including NBC DC and a reporter there, taking things from the first Trump administration, actions that were done in 2016 and 2017, and equating that this crash at DCA could have been avoided if Trump didn't do these things 8 or 9 years ago. That's what you had as the immediate reaction to this crash. Left-wing, foaming at the mouth, liberal Democrats that work at these media outlets trying to blame the president. Now, let me say this. I believe that when you are the president or you're the CEO or you're the whatever of a company or the United States, the buck does stop there. Absolutely. So the left uses the tragedy to blame the president, of which they hate. I got sent a screenshot this morning about a post on Facebook. And it says, January 20th, FAA director fired. January 21st, aircraft controller hiring freeze. January 22nd, Aviation Safety Commission disbanded. January 28th, buyout/retirement demand sent to existing employees. And January 29th, first American mid-air collision in 16 years. And it's just 11 days in. So the left believes that it's appropriate to blame the president for this crash. That it is his fault. Things that he has done in 11 days caused this crash. And so they're given full availability to do that. They're allowed to blame the president of the United States. And at that point, when somebody makes an allegation against you and puts you at fault for something, which is what Democrats have done on this plane crash, you have two options. You either ignore, which means not respond, or you fight back. And one thing that has been incredibly clear over the last decade that Donald Trump has been involved in politics is he is not going to sit by. He is not going to sit on his ass and allow individuals to throw allegations and accusations at him or his team without fighting back. Now, you can agree with that or you can disagree with that. You can say that's good, that's bad. For better or for worse, it is irrelevant. Donald Trump has been very consistent when individuals make BS and nonsensical allegations against him. He has been very clear in his stance and very consistent in his stance that he is going to fight back. And that's what he did yesterday. So is it the appropriate time to do so? Who is the arbiter of that? Who's the arbiter? And I'll give you a counter. Is it appropriate the second after a shooting takes place in the country to have Democrats on Twitter, including members of Congress, claiming that law-abiding citizens that own firearms are the reason that these things take place and we need common sense gun reform and common sense gun control? So what's the timeline? When is it appropriate to quote-unquote politicize it? I hate that term. Oh, well, you know, we can't politicize this issue. We politicize everything. Get off your high horse. Step down off your ivory freaking castle and get back to reality. Everything that happens is politicized in our society. Whether it's a plane crash, a shooting, a car accident, whatever. Everything is politicized 24/7. So please spare me your outrage over the politicization of something that went on. Please. Spare me. I can't take it. Don't blow smoke up my ass about politicization. It happens on both sides of the political aisle constantly. So please, stop clutching your pearls over it. It's exhausting because it's constant. Oh my God, we have to stop politicizing this. Okay, phenomenal. Maybe next time there's a tragedy that fits your political ideology, your political agenda, maybe you'll say the same thing. But no, of course. So Trump fought back. Trump battled back and pushed back against the narrative being run by Democrats, being run by the liberal media. And that's exactly what you should expect from him. He's been very consistent in that. So I felt the need to bring that forward because it's the typical hypocrisy from liberals, typical hypocrisy from the left-wing media, which of course are one and the same. Just, it needs to be called out. Just remember that these individuals have no moral authority, no moral high ground or moral authority on anything that they discuss and anything they talk about. They will politicize a school shooting to fit their gun control narrative beyond belief. And I'm going to be honest with you, I don't think Trump politicized the press conference yesterday. I don't think, now there was a couple of shots in there on the previous administration, and I think rightfully so. He brought up about hiring practices within this same administration that we now know this morning was one person short in the air traffic control tower, the ATC. And I would suspect, don't know this to be a fact, but I would suspect that Trump had some of this information potentially beforehand. That he may have known that they were one shy in the air traffic control tower before it became public from the New York Times last night. And so he called out staffing, which, as we learn in the weeks and months ahead, which Trump also mentioned, you know, these reports take years to come out. We got to make sure this thing happens quickly. As the weeks and months go on and we learn more about this tragedy, as I mentioned earlier, it is likely to be a calamity of issues that occurred. This is likely going to be one of them. At least preliminary information indicates you had one person directing helicopters and planes, which was not common for the amount of volume that was happening at this time. So I wanted to get that off my chest. And don't for a second cowtail to any Democrats to talk about politicization of issues. Yet their friends in the mainstream media are the ones promoting actions from an administration 8 years ago as the cause of a plane crash, which is literally what's happening and continued to happen. So that's the latest that we've got on the issue out of DCA, the horrific plane crash that claimed 67 lives Wednesday night. We'll see if we get any new details over the weekend. So yesterday we had Tulsi Gabbard in Washington, D.C. in her Senate confirmation taking place. You also had Kash Patel in D.C. as well. Both of those individuals making their way in front of members of the Senate to go through what we've seen, the kind of the political freak show over the last couple of days, whether it's RFK, whether it was Pete Hegseth. It was now Tulsi Gabbard and Kash Patel. Kash Patel is going to be a phenomenal FBI director. This is a guy, and I knew a little bit about his backstory, not as much as I thought I did. This is a guy that has done the work. This is a guy that has been involved in various forms of law enforcement and the legal system that seemingly makes him very well suited for this job. And one thing that he has been and continues to be adamant about is the fact that the politicization of these entities like the FBI, like the DOJ, this stuff needs to stop. And as he noted, he's been the victim of it firsthand. President Trump has been the victim of it firsthand, with the FBI raiding Mar-a-Lago, guns ablazing, to take a bunch of documents, dump the box out on the floor, stage them for a cool picture, and then leak it to the media. That's the institution known as the Federal Bureau of Investigation. That's the kind of great work that they've done over the last couple of years. And again, important to note, with criticism of the FBI, we're not talking about the agents. We're not talking about the non-civilians that work with the FBI. We're talking about the top-level individuals that are corrupt and power-hungry that have taken this organization of good men and women that believe in the rule of law, believe in law enforcement, and those individuals have used their positions of power to go after their political enemies. Not completely dissimilar from J. Edgar Hoover. So you had Cash Patel on the FBI side, and then you had Tulsi Gabbard yesterday in front of a similar committee in regards to the Director of National Intelligence. That's the position that Trump has appointed her to take over. Still has to go through the Senate confirmation. And she kind of, she mentioned something yesterday about the United States and our constant push to control countries across the world. This constant restructuring of power that the United States does, where we overthrow a dictatorship by funding some sort of rebellion, you know, funding this terror group, or these are just moderate rebels, so we'll fund these individuals. Hopefully they'll take over the government so the United States can have an in. This is just typical stuff that you expect out of these three-letter agencies. Tulsi Gabbard called this stuff out and put this stuff on full exposure yesterday. Take a listen to a back-and-forth exchange with her and Mark Kelly. Take a listen.
Sir Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Colonel Gabbard, when Russia was denying us use of chemical weapons, they accused the U.S. of supporting terrorists. This is a line that Putin used frequently during the Syrian civil war as he supported Assad. Syrian officials made similar comments. They did it repeatedly. They did it in public. They did it at the United Nations. In 2016, you gave an interview in which you said, and this is a quote, "The U.S. is providing direct and indirect support to terrorist groups in order to overthrow the Syrian government." And in 2019, on the Democratic presidential debate stage, you said of President Trump, this is a quote, "This current president is continuing to betray us. We were supposed to be going after Al-Qaeda, but over years now, not only have we not gone after Al-Qaeda, our president is supporting Al-Qaeda." So I'm interested to hear, what was your goal in saying these things? And did you consider, before saying them, the motives of Iran and Russia, what their motives might have been before making these claims?
So before we get to her answer, this is, of course, the same sorry Democrat tactic that they've used on Tulsi. You heard it with everybody's favorite presidential candidate, Hillary Clinton, who claimed that Tulsi Gabbard, who is a decorated member of our U.S. military, was the head of the Democrat, or the vice chair of the Democrat National Committee when Hillary Clinton got the nomination in 2016, served as a Democrat in Congress, that she is a Russian asset. Because, you know, it's, of course, the Republicans are the ones that are, of course, in bed with Russia, right? You'll hear that Trump is just Putin's puppet. Yet somehow, it is the Democrats that are ones that are always yelling and screaming about Russia. They're the ones that are always talking about it. I don't ever hear Republicans talking in this vein. But yet, and anytime anybody calls out, you know, norms out of our central intelligence agencies, then they're, oh, you're just a Russian asset. Russian disinformation. So Tulsi Gabbard responds to Mark Kelly's line of questioning, which is all wrapped around the fact that she's not an American somehow. She, you know, only put her life on the line to protect and serve our country, but she's a Russian asset, right? That seems to really add up.
Senator, as someone who enlisted in the military specifically because of Al-Qaeda's terrorist attack on 9/11 and committing myself and my life to doing what I could to defeat these terrorists, It was shocking and a betrayal to me and every person who was killed on 9/11, their families and my brothers and sisters in uniform. When, as a member of Congress, I learned about President Obama's dual programs that he had begun really to overthrow the regime of Syria, and being willing to, through the CIA's Timber Sycamore program that has now been made public, of working with and arming and equipping al-Qaeda in an effort to overthrow that regime, starting yet another regime change war in the Middle East. DOD train and equip program, again, begun under President Obama, is widely been known, looked at, and studied, that ultimately resulted in over $500 million being used to train who they called moderate rebels, but were actually fighters working with and aligned with al-Qaeda's affiliate on the ground in Syria, all to move forward with their regime change and not acknowledging what was obvious at the time and what has unfortunately borne true, which was that a regime change war in Syria, much like the regime change wars in Iraq, the toppling of Gaddafi and Mubarak, while these are all dictators, would likely result in the rise of Islamist extremists like al-Qaeda taking power. I shed no tears for the fall of the Assad regime, but today we have an Islamist extremist who is now in charge of Syria, as I said, who danced on the streets to celebrate the 9/11 attack, who ruled over Idlib with an Islamist extremist governance, and who has already begun to persecute and kill and arrest religious minorities like Christians in Syria.
I understand.
Why that should be acceptable to anyone is beyond me.
It shouldn't
be. It is certainly
not
in our interest.
And I understand, but I appreciate your answer. And thank you. My concern has to do with the tendency to repeat Russian and Syrian, and even in some cases, I think we'll get into in the closed session, Iranian information, and to discount what comes from our intelligence community.
Oh, Mike, can you imagine discounting what comes from our intelligence communities? I mean, they've never lied to us in the past, right? Three-letter agencies have never lied and misled the American public. I mean, have they? What are you talking about? You've never had agency groups like the NSA conducting mass unconstitutional spying operations on U.S. citizens, right? That's never happened. You've never had the CIA involved in elections taking place all throughout the Middle East and in portions of South America. That's never happened, right? I mean, that's... Tulsi Gabbard is a real threat to what I actually think is the quote-unquote deep state. She completely laid out the Obama administration's attempt to play both sides of the issue and force regime change in foreign lands, which is something the United States has an awful track record of doing. She just completely exposed it. This is why she and somebody like Kash Patel are such a threat to these institutions. They are such a threat to these organizations that operate under the nose of the American public, that operate in shady, very disingenuous ways, things that you and I will never know about, things that will be declassified for the rest of time. That's the kind of actions and efforts that these groups and agencies are involved in. And Tulsi Gabbard says, I'm calling this stuff out. And what is Mark Kelly's response? It sounds like you're repeating a bunch of Russian information and you're discrediting our intelligence agencies. Yeah, here's a wild thought. And it goes to show you. I mentioned this last night. We had our first ever... a monthly hangout as part of our Patreon, which you can get information on and support over at patreon.com/Nick Craig. You get access to the daily show notes, as well as a monthly kind of, I'm calling it a hangout. It's a Zoom call where we chatted politics, talked about some issues, and some additional content coming soon. You can get all of that at patreon.com/Nick Craig. We were talking about this last night, is that all of these hearings, whether it was RFK or Hegseth or Kash Patel or Tulsi, whoever it's been, It has proven to me that the Democrats, in this case, Mark Kelly fits squarely in, they have absolutely zero clue and zero idea what the American people are thinking. They are completely disconnected and removed from reality. When Mark Kelly calls out Tulsi Gabbard as a Russian asset, that was the attempt of his question, and says, I can't believe that you're not trusting our intelligence agencies. That just goes to show you the level of disconnection. Hey, Mark, maybe you're still up in space. Maybe we'll bring you back down to orbit here for a second. The American people don't trust the government. Wide swaths of the American public don't believe a damn word that comes out of the government, whether it's FEMA, whether it's the NIH, whether it's CIA, FBI, NSA. People don't trust the government. They have been lied to ad nauseum. And the most public example of this was COVID-19, with NIH and Anthony Fauci admitting that they made up rules and explicitly lied about things like getting the COVID-19 vaccine to stop the spread of the infection and stop the transmission, which were never true. No studies ever proved that. Nothing proved it. But that's what he said. And he was the government expert under that issue. The 6 feet, when you had to stand in line at a store with all these stupid duct-taped X's on the floor to be 6 feet away from somebody wearing a cloth mask that doesn't stop transmission, we were told just a couple of months ago that that was made up. It was a best guess. There was zero, and I mean zero, scientific evidence to back it up. Nothing. It was just pulled out of Fauci's ass. So when Mark Kelly goes, oh, I can't believe you're not trusting the information coming out of our agencies, nobody does. These, you mean like the intelligence officials, maybe all the ones that signed that letter that said that the Hunter Biden laptop was Russian propaganda? Are those the kinds of officials that we should be trusting? I'm gonna lay down my faith into those intelligence officials. You'll remember that, right? A whole bunch of scholarly, intelligent folk told us that the story about Hunter Biden's laptop was Russian disinformation. Now, of course, we know years later that that wasn't true. They signed that letter for political purposes. The Hunter Biden laptop has been 100% corroborated and verified. And the FBI had it for a year prior to the New York Post breaking the story. So Mark Kelly proves how out of touch he is with the vast majority of the American public. We don't trust these agencies. We don't trust the government. And I think Tulsi Gabbard is going to do a phenomenal job dealing with that. I think she's going to do a phenomenal job as the Director of National Intelligence, getting the U.S. out of things that we have no business being involved in. And she went through the track record of what went on in Syria under Obama. What about Need for Speed, the gun trafficking operation that the federal government was running on the southern border? This stuff isn't conspiracy. This stuff is not random online fodder and weird kind of deep lore information. This stuff is now, with government documents, completely exposed. And this is the kind of stuff that was going on. These are the kinds of programs that were being run under previous administrations. A gun buying and gun trafficking program being run by the Central Intelligence Agency under Barack Obama. And when they said they weren't doing it, if you believed them, now that makes you an idiot and a fool, because they were, of course, lying to you. So I'm looking forward to Tulsi and Cash being confirmed. With Tulsi, another example of somebody that was, of course, in favor with the Democrats, only to start questioning their authority, questioning the way in which they were operating, to now be exposed and exposed, I put that in air quotes, and pushed to the back burner and called a Russian propagandist, a puppet, all of the fun things that Democrats do. I've got a very interesting story coming up. The FCC, Federal Communications Commission, is launching an investigation into NPR and PBS. We'll have those details coming up here in just a few minutes. Want to remind you to check out the show on Rumble, rumble.com/The Nick Craig Show. You can also get that link by visiting the website nickcraig.com, where you can check out the podcast after the fact, or find the link to all of the live shows, rumble.com/The Nick Craig Show. We'll cover this very interesting FCC story coming up after this. You're listening to The Nick Craig Show, streaming live this morning on YouTube, Rumble, and X. And welcome back to The Nick Craig Show, streaming live on this Friday morning on YouTube, Rumble, and X. Appreciate you being part of the show this morning. Public media. This is an interesting conversation, and it's not necessarily a new one. You've got two major outlets, NPR, which stands for National Public Radio. I like to call it National Panhandler Radio, because all they do is beg for money constantly. And PBS, the Public Broadcasting System. There has been a lot of scrutiny and a lot of criticism over the last couple of years, specifically at very high levels with Trump, calling out these agencies for their media bias. Because yes, in their goal, in their operation as public broadcasters, they have extreme political bias. You'll remember back to a story early last year in which an NPR employee described the stories that they were purposefully burying at NPR because they may have looked bad for Biden and may have looked good for Trump. He did a complete and total expose on the organization as a whole. He worked in their DC bureau, which is where a lot of the NPR content flows out to all of their member stations. And like here in Wilmington, WHQR, an NPR member station. So we've got a report this morning exclusively over at the New York Times. They're the ones reporting this. And the headline is FCC chair, whose name is Brendan Carr, orders investigation into NPR and PBS sponsorships. Ah, that's pretty interesting. See, because part of the fact that these individuals like PBS and NPR are nonprofits and publicly funded by taxpayers, they can't run commercials. If you've ever listened to traditional, conventional commercial radio, they play some music or there's a talk show host and they go to a break, they play some commercials, then they come back. That's how commercial stations fund their operation. NPR can't do that. PBS can't do that. So they do a couple of different things. In the case of NPR, they do these panhandling campaigns where they beg and plead their listeners for money ad nauseum for weeks and months on end. Takes up the entire days of programming. And then you've also got what is known as underwriting. Not advertising, not sponsoring, but underwriting, where major companies and major businesses write very large checks to these companies. And of course, because they don't call them advertisers or advertising, they're able to skirt under the radar. And Brendan Carr, the chairman of the FCC, says, well, we need to take a look at this. So let's go through the story. The chairman of the Federal Communications Commission has waded into the politicized debate over NPR and PBS, ordering an investigation that he says could be relevant in lawmakers' decisions about whether to continue funding the public news organization. Brendan Carr, the chairman, said in a letter to NPR and PBS on Wednesday that the inquiry would focus on whether the news organization's member stations violated government rules by recognizing financial sponsors on air. They're not allowed to do that because they are nonprofits. They're non-commercial broadcasters. Mr. Carr said that NPR and PBS stations operate as non-commercial broadcast organizations, but that they may be airing, quote, announcements that cross the line into prohibited commercial advertisements. And there is a very big difference between commercial and non-commercial radio. You'll note a lot of religious programming is on non-commercial radio, K-Love and Catholic radio and things like that. Those are non-commercial entities. They're called non-coms for a reason. And there are very, very strict and specific rules about funding. Now, K-Love, it raises their money through tithing and various sorts of donation drives, and that stuff's okay. But NPR and PBS have major corporate sponsors that are backing them. And according to the FCC commissioner, the chairman of the organization, they could be potentially crossing the line as to what they're allowed to legally do. Carr wrote in the letter, to the extent that these taxpayer dollars are being used to support for-profit endeavors or an entity that is airing commercial advertisements, then that would further undermine any case for continuing to fund NPR and PBS with taxpayer dollars. The letter is the latest action. Now, of course, we'll get into the New York Times opinion on it, which is funny, so we'll read through it. The letter is the latest action from President Trump's allies to target NPR and PBS stations and the Corporation for Public Broadcasters, a taxpayer-funded organization that backs them. Executives at NPR and PBS stations have been bracing for a potential battle over government funding, gaming out financial worst-case scenarios. And really, this comes down to an important question, and one that I have an answer to. Should taxpayers, at any amount of money, whether it's large or small, should taxpayers fund NPR? Should taxpayers fund PBS? The answer is no. The answer is no. The kind of content that they produce, with the bias that they produce, should be commercial radio. You're very familiar with more right-leaning conservative talk. You're familiar with conservative talk radio stations, of which many of you are familiar, I spent some time on. We're commercial entities, meaning that if people are not listening and advertisers are not spending money, we cease to exist. That's how a for-profit entity works. But NPR and PBS, they don't have to worry about that because they get hundreds of millions of dollars, whether between state and local groups, to fund their outlets throughout the year. And they're not producing content that I would see would be in the best fit of public interest. They're constantly playing politics. I mean, you could just go to the NPR website and look at their political news. Look at their political bias. And do they do some work that is pretty good? Yes. Do some of their member stations do good work? Yes, absolutely. I'm not saying shut down NPR. I'm not saying shut down PBS. I'm saying that they shouldn't be receiving taxpayer dollars. If they want to operate in the manner in which they do, then they need to be like every other commercial radio and television station and sell advertising. And if they're unsuccessful in selling advertising, well, then they have to close. Aqua Blue is commenting this morning over on our Rumble channel and says, PBS used to be educational, especially for kids. Documentaries on national parks, etc. They've turned into political theater now. Oh, they absolutely have. Now, unfortunately, hold on a second. I'm on the NPR website right now. Looking at this. Look at this message that just pops up. We put our trust in you two. Time after time, you tell us that you come here because you trust our reporting. Well, I've never said that about NPR. Accurate, complete, and fair journalism costs the same to produce here as anywhere else. Yet the NPR network remains accessible to everyone, regardless of their ability to pay. How do we do it? We trust that you will pitch in with financial support when you are asked for it. We're asking you now. So were we right? Yes, I'll donate. And of course, look at this. They want you to make a donation to your local NPR station, WHQR here in Wilmington. Again, I will say it. I do not think that NPR should be shut down. I don't want NPR or PBS to be shut down. I want them to stop receiving taxpayer dollars, and I want them to operate as for-profit entities like conservative media outlets do that don't get free money from the federal government and have these weird, ambiguous rules about sponsorship and advertising to push their political narrative forward, because that's what they do. You can be upset that individuals like Dan Bongino and Buck Sexton and Clay Travis are on the radio, but they're for-profit businesses. Companies are supporting them based on their audience that they can convert into clients and sales. That's how it works. There's no free money parade waltzing around conservative talk radio. It doesn't exist. But yet NPR and PBS are able to do that. So back to the New York Times piece. Mr. Carr, who was appointed under Trump, said he did not see a reason for lawmakers to continue funding the organizations. He said he planned to notify members of Congress about the investigation. Catherine Mayer, the chief executive of NPR, said in a statement that that the organization practices of using sponsorships, also known as underwriting, complies with federal regulations. She said, quote, "We are confident any review of our programming and underwriting practices will confirm NPR's adherence to these rules. We have worked for decades with the FCC in support of non-commercial educational broadcasters who provide essential information, educational programming, and emergency alerts to local communities across the United States." Emergency alerts are also operated and paid for by commercial stations who, again, don't get federal money to do it. And by the way, have to spend at their own expense to be part of the EAS emergency alert system. But, you know, we'll ignore that fact. PBS said in a statement that it was proud of, quote, "non-commercial education programming and worked diligently to comply with the FCC underwriting regulations." Two FCC commissioners released statements taking issue with Mr. Carr's investigation. Anna Gomez, a Democrat, said that the investigation appeared to be an attempt to, quote, "weaponize the power of the FCC." Gregory Starks, also a Democrat, said that Mr. Carr's statement gave him serious concern. Well, if PBS and NPR are fully following the FCC's rules and regulations like they claim, then the investigation should be pretty quick and pretty closed, cut and dry. Hey, we did the investigation. You guys are following all the rules. Okay. NPR and PBS for decades aired sponsorships under rules set forth by the government, while public broadcasters are restricted by law from accepting traditional commercials. The FCC has become more permissive over the years about what public stations are allowed to air. The FCC's evolving stance on this issue has gradually allowed public radio stations to become less dependent on government funding. Eric Numes, a former NPR executive and co-founder of the audio consulting and production company Magnificent Noise, said that sponsorships and underwriting differ sharply from advertising on commercial TV and radio in several respects. Oh, really? Okay, let's hear. "The difference is, in a commercial, the sponsors can say anything they want. It's their time. In an underwriting situation, the station provides an acknowledgement of who's providing the funding, along with basic information about the underwriter." Really? So when you are listening to a commercial radio station and they say, "Oh, the news this hour is brought to you by Joe's Plumbing Service. Have a leaky hot water heater? Call Joe's at 555-5555. When they do that, that is vastly different from what NPR does. No, it's the same damn thing. But see, they're high class over at NPR and PBS. It's not advertising. It's underwriting. This is corporate underwriting by major drug companies and airlines and other things of that nature. Underwriting, not advertising. No. That's for you poor free market capital individuals No, no, no. We have underwriters that support our programming. Bills are working their way through Congress that would defund public media, including the No Propaganda Act introduced by Senator John Kennedy of Louisiana and Representative Scott Perry of Pennsylvania, as well as the Defund NPR Act introduced by Representative Jim Banks of Indiana. Earlier this week, NPR executives told staff members that a memo issued by the Trump administration imperiled two grant programs benefiting local stations. But I thought there was such little money. What's the big deal? You're constantly told by the NPR folk that the amount of money they receive from governments is so minuscule, then who the hell cares? Go get another corporate sponsor. Go get another underwriter then. Citing guidance from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, Mr. Trump's administration rescinded that memo after it was blocked by a judge. Seth Stern, the director of advocacy at Freedom of the Press Foundation, said he believed that Mr. Carr seemed to be setting up a legal pretext for interfering with public media. Again, we're not talking about, I don't believe Brendan Carr's letter, at least from what I looked at, doesn't say that we need to shut down NPR or PBS. Says they need to stop receiving taxpayer dollars because they are a media outlet of the Democrats. Well, let's see what Mr. Stern has to say. The end of Mr. Carr's letter tellingly goes far beyond underwriting and talks about his thoughts on whether public media should be funded at all, and notes that this underwriting issue might be relevant to broadcast a broader legislative debate. That was troubling to read. Oh, so troubling. So NPR actually wrote a story on this themselves, and it's a lot of rehashing of what you just heard in the New York Times piece. But they go through and they talk about some of the various things that they have to be obligated under and dealing with some of their corporate underwriting and, you know, things like this. On average, NPR's member stations get 10% of their funds from the U.S. Chartered Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Rural stations are generally amongst the most dependent on such federal largesse. As a result, public broadcasters have often enjoyed bipartisan support. 10% of their funding is a significant amount of money. And again, if there's this bipartisan group, if there's all of these people which are listening, which, by the way, NPR stations are incredibly popular. If you look at radio station ratings across the country, NPR stations are very popular. If that's the case, we're in a perilous time in our country right now. We're $36 trillion in debt. Everybody's having to make sacrifices. I believe that maybe NPR and PBS should make some of those same sacrifices. Go out and raise that additional money yourself. Go out and get that money from underwriters or sponsors or donors, which, again, I don't have an issue with any of that. That there becomes a time and place where it's the use, again, of the federal government to be doing something like underwriting NPR and PBS and giving them tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars a year. 10% of their funds. These stations aren't making $30,000 a year. Some of these stations are pulling in millions upon millions of dollars. And 10% of that funding is not a small portion. So that's the latest in regards to Brendan Carr, who will be a phenomenal FCC chairman. And the battle against NPR and PBS and should or should they not be receiving some of those federal dollars. It's a very interesting question. You can comment on that on our YouTube channel or Rumble or give me a tweet over on X. As part of our hangout that we had last night, I was asking for some feedback, and there was some interest in getting the ability to text comments into the show, whether that be live or pre-recorded. So I'll be having that individual ability hopefully on Monday. I'll have a text message line where you can throw your comments into the text message, and if you're listening to the podcast later on in the afternoon, I can mention the comments the next morning, or if you're listening live, you can do that. in part by texting in that live. So hopefully we'll have that set up on Monday morning for that. Again, quick reminder, if you would like to support the show and get access to bonus content, including show notes and more, you can get those daily show notes over at patreon.com/Nick Craig. Thanks to everybody who has jumped in and supporting the program thus far, and everybody that showed up to the hangout last night. We'll do another one of those coming up in the latter parts of February. Again, appreciate your support on this endeavor, this mission. It's an interesting one, kind of breaking away from a stable paycheck in regards to corporate media and doing this solo, but your support has been greatly, greatly appreciated. Well, that's going to do it for a Friday edition of the Nick Craig Show. Coming up Monday morning, we'll be joined exclusively by New Hanover County Commissioner Dane Scalise. We'll talk about diversity, equity, and inclusion. Have a great weekend.